Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here for a number of reasons. It's our first time to Nashville, and we're very much enjoying this great city. It is a return for me to a period of my life that I love very much as a university professor. So that's the second reason why I'm absolutely delighted. And the third is to have a small role in honoring the late and distinguished Jonathan I. Charney. The ambassador would add there's a fourth reason, which is to promote Canadian, or rather our consul general would add, he was formerly ambassador, to promote Canadian-American exchange. And I'm very happy to be exhibit A in today's particular exchange. With all the trade figures being bandied about, you may have got the impression that that's the only sort of exchange that happens. Today at lunch, I was told of a prominent American trade lawyer who wrote a book on Canada and the United States and neatly summed up our relationship in the title, Swine and Pine. I hope that I can convince you there's a little more than swine and pine, and that we also exchange and share ideas and values, and that we can learn from each other, as I know I have already learned from speaking with so many of your distinguished professors and judges. Today, as has been announced, I'd like to comment or talk about intolerance, focusing primarily on the 20th century and asking the question of whether the 21st century will be better than its predecessor. The 20th century, I believe, will go down as one of the most intolerant and hence the bloodiest of all history. We stand today at the threshold of a new century. So far, there is little sign that we are doing better than we did before. But the century is young. There is still hope. Whether that hope is realized will depend on you, the generation who will stamp the character of the 21st century. From the first year of the 20th century to the last, and through every decade in between, intolerance raised its ugly head. At the same time, however, a contrary moral current was gathering strength, the current of tolerance. In my lecture today, I'd like to trace how these two currents intertwined during the 20th century. And overall, I'd like to suggest that intolerance got the better of tolerance, although it failed to rout it. The struggle between the two currents continues into the 21st century. I believe that intolerance will always be with us, born of deeply rooted human qualities, insularity, greed, tribalism. My more modest hope is not that we will eradicate intolerance in the 21st century, but that we will continue to strengthen the ethic of tolerance, which is equally part of human nature. The catalog of intolerance in the 20th century is so vast that in order to understand it, I think it helps to divide it into subcategories. And I've tried to do that and focus my lecture around them. First, intolerance of ideas. Second, intolerance of political views. Third, intolerance of other ethnic groups and races. Fourth, economic intolerance or intolerance for economic gain. And finally, intolerance in the context of war. The categories overlap, they're not watertight, and often one kind of intolerance goes hand in hand with another. Underlying all these categories is a common feature. The person or group that is not being tolerated is perceived as being different from the group that is inflicting the intolerance. They are the other, to borrow Jean-Paul Sartre's famous phrase. And as such, they're seen as less than human, or sometimes not human at all. You know, one of the good qualities of human nature is our ability to empathize with others. The ability to share pain, sympathy, laughter. We are born with this. We share other people's pain and suffering. But rage or fear or ideological belief can negate this natural sympathy. The systemic suppression of empathy in individuals and groups almost always involves making them see the target as something less than fully human. Fear, rage, or belief transposes the human being in the sights of the assassin's revolver into an object to be annihilated. Let's return to the categories I mentioned a moment ago. The first is intolerance of ideas. The ideas may be of many types, almost any type. They might be about how wealth ought to be distributed in society. They might be how a country ought to be run. They might be about God or the proper way to worship. Whatever their source, the history of the 20th century, like that of centuries before, teaches that ideas have the power to suppress our instincts for empathy and sympathy and transform them into intolerance. The product of misdirected ideology is often the death of someone or many by execution or assassination. In the 16th century, people who refused to convert to the Catholic faith were burned at the stake. In the 20th century, assassination was the more common manifestation of idea-driven intolerance. Martin Gilbert, historian, says, assassination marked the 20th century from the start, and those assassinated were often those who sought toleration, amelioration, compromise, and an end to suffering. Jean Jaurès was killed in Paris in 1914 for opposing the European War. Mahatma Gandhi was killed in Delhi in 1948 for seeking Hindu-Muslim reconciliation. Martin Luther King was killed in 1968 in Memphis, not far from here, for seeking a nonviolent end to racial inequities. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was killed for his efforts to end warfare in the Middle East. And Yitzhak Rabin was killed in Tel Aviv in 1995 for trying to bring Palestinians and Israelis together. The ultimate manifestation of ideological intolerance is terrorism and the suicide bomber, a late 20th century development that has emerged as a mass threat in the 21st century. Terrorism takes execution and assassination and ratchets them up to the ultimate notch on the scale of inhumanity. Execution and assassination, terrible though they are aimed at a particular person who is transformed by ideology into incarnate evil. This limits their impact. Terrorism, by contrast, takes random aim in pursuit of the idea, be it religion or statehood or some other perceived good. The perpetrator is prepared to indiscriminately take hostages and kill innocents. It is no longer necessary to perceive the particular target as personally evil or inhuman. Instead, as explained by Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who was recently awarded the Templeton Prize, the terrorists search for ideological purity, interesting phrase, ideological purity, leads him to separate himself from the community, seeing the rest of the world as so filled with evil that anything may be done, anyone may be killed. Thus, terrorism knows no limits, no bounds, moral or otherwise. The second category I mentioned was intolerance of political views, and it often overlaps with ideological intolerance. But the two categories aren't identical. Just as non-political ideas may fuel intolerance, so may political goals that are not tied to ideology do the same thing. The Tsar's armies did not mow down hundreds of Russian peasants outside the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg in 1905 because of ideas, so much as because they posed a threat to established power and the order of things. Saddam Hussein did not murder thousands of Kurds, not to mention his own Sunni tribesmen and women, because of ideas, so much as once again, simply because they posed a threat to power. Ethno-racial intolerance, the third category, is ancient. Once commonplace, it has for centuries been denounced by civilized nations. Yet it motivated one of the ugliest episodes in human history in the mid-20th century, and continues to rear its ugly head even now in the 21st. The 20th century witnessed many attempts to annihilate races of human beings perceived as inferior. The Armenian Genocide marred the century's first decades, and the exterminations of Muslims by Serbs and vice versa in the ex-Yugoslavia scarred its final years. Between these two bookends lies the Holocaust, in which one of the most civilized nations of the world systematically set out to rid Europe of Jews and came perilously close to succeeding. And in what name all this death and suffering? The name no more and no less than the other of a different ethnic group or race, and different and hence worthy of extermination. Ethno-racist intolerance remains a problem in the 21st century. It lies behind the horrors in Darfur, where black people from the south and west find themselves victimized by armed groups with slightly whiter skin. In the form of tribalism, it feeds local wars around the world. Today we read of the horrors at work in Sudan, and not long ago the world witnessed in shock the mass killings of Tutsis by Hutus and vice versa in the African countries of Rwanda and Burundi, where tensions still run high. Even where it does not result in violence and killing, discrimination on the basis of racial intolerance takes a huge toll in terms of well-being and productivity of marginalized groups, as well as in social stability. The history of racial segregation is etched in the souls of those who lived its reality in the American South. But it is not the only example of racial discrimination in the 20th century. In that century, many Canadians of European descent were hostile to Asian immigrants and their Canadian-born descendants. The racist attitudes culminated in the internment of Japanese Canadians during the Second World War, and the same thing happened to Japanese Americans. Canada and the United States have seen wave upon wave of immigration over the decades. And throughout the world, people continue to move from less affluent countries to affluent countries. In part because of the mistakes of the 20th century, our newest arrivals come at a time of greater sensitivity to cultural difference and greater appreciation for diversity. Racial discrimination has been transmuted into issues of how far the traditional society should go to accommodate the language, religion, and mores of the newcomers. A nation may rightly feel it is important to protect the core values that define it. Values like democracy, the equality of women, a common language or languages, and a common legal system. Values that may be perceived by some to be threatened by a foreign invading culture. Tolerance does not require abandonment of a nation's defining values, nor does it require that we love everyone we see or meet. What it does require is accommodation to the extent that this can be achieved without unduly trampling on the rights of others or sacrificing our shared values. It requires line drawing, sometimes difficult and controversial, and I know as a judge who's had to draw some of those lines how difficult it is. It requires cross-group conversations. Dialogue must replace discrimination. The fourth category of intolerance is economic intolerance, also has ancient roots. Throughout the 20th century, economic exploitation was a persistent source of violations of rights. Historically, economic exploitation has marched under many banners, from slavery to imperial entitlement to raw, unbridled capitalism. Slavery was the earliest and starkest incarnation of economic exploitation. I don't know if any of you have seen the film currently playing, Amazing Grace, which came at the time of, I believe, the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery in England, and tells the story of Wilberforce, a parliamentarian who fought long and hard to end the British slave trade. With the outlawing of slavery in England and Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries and its termination in the United States after the Civil War, this form of economic exploitation became rarer, although slavery is still practiced in many parts of the world. In the 20th century, economic exploitation morphed into other forms, such as the colonial practice of forcing local inhabitants to produce goods for the foreign master. One of the worst examples was the treatment of natives of the Congo Free State, then known as the Belgian Congo, in the early part of the century. The Congo Free State was created and treated as the personal property of King Leopold II of the Belgians. In search for rubber and ivory, the king's servants practiced widespread slavery and mutilation of the local population. These practices ended only in 1908, when, in a blow against this intolerance, the Belgian Parliament forced the king to cede his domain to the state. The world of the 21st century is newly sensitive to the evils of intolerance based on economic exploitation. It is all too easy, we now recognize, to treat local populations as fodder for our economic cannons. We also recognize that those likely to serve as fodder are the powerless and the vulnerable, men, women, and children from socially marginalized groups. We know that in certain parts of the world, the use of such people as labor keeps production costs low. On the other hand, we are also told that even the low wages these people earn may improve their lot and alleviate their utter poverty. The choices aren't easy. Most, however, would agree that workers in all cases should be treated as human beings, clothed with human dignity, and that their situation and the advantage that the rich and powerful can derive from that situation should not be allowed to degenerate into discrimination and intolerance, which turns economic partnership into economic exploitation. Finally, I come to the intolerance of war, and I'd like to focus not generally on how bad war is, but the way in which warfare is conducted. I referred earlier to Sir Martin Gilbert, the British historian who, for many, wrote the definitive biography of Sir Winston Churchill, England's great war leader. Gilbert says this: "One of the greatest intolerances of the 20th century was war, not the defense of national interests, nor the tenacity of fighting men and women without whose patriotism national independence would be destroyed, but the subjection of fighting men to the harshest conditions of war making, including trench warfare, poison gas, flamethrowers, napalm, cluster bombs, and landmines." Sir Martin goes on to add aerial bombardment to his list of what he calls the gross intolerances of modern warfare. He cites Winston Churchill, who, when asked toward the end of his life how he summed up the world in which he had lived, gave a rather positive verdict due to, he said, advances in medicine and the healing sciences. But he said, with one exception, and I quote, "I regret that mankind ever learned to fly." In 1942, watching a Royal Air Force film of the bombing of a German city, Churchill, who had himself ordered such raids, anguished, and again I quote, "Are we beasts? Are we taking this too far? Wars may be unfortunate necessities if we are to protect our sovereignty and the values we hold dear. But those charged with waging them should never forget to ask themselves Churchill's questions. Are we beasts? Are we taking this too far?" I have described the intolerances that marred the 20th century and threatened to mar the 21st. But for a few minutes, I'd like to turn to a brighter side, and that is the opposing current that grew and gathered strength in the 20th century, the current of human rights and tolerance. As I mentioned at the outset, tolerance has always been present side by side with intolerance. It's the other side of human nature. For every assassination, there have been horrified onlookers. For every minority that has felt the brunt of majority power, there have been defenders. Slavery was criticized long before its abolition. Economic exploitation and inhumane treatment of soldiers and prisoners has long been condemned. The current of tolerance that should not surprise us, tolerance and respect for those less powerful and less fortunate, finds expression in all the world's great religions, although sadly some have sometimes degraded particular religions into messages of intolerance. Tolerance is natural, and it reflects our empathetic, sympathetic, cooperative side. In the mid-20th century, a great breakthrough was made for tolerance, one that moved it from the shore eddies of history into its central stream. I refer to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. It is a source of pride to my country and that the principal draftsman of the Declaration was a Canadian, John Peters Humphrey. The Declaration was a response in part to the horrors of the Holocaust, where intolerance expressed itself as the imprisonment with the view to an ultimate eradication of designated groups of human beings, notably Jews. For a while, secrecy and settled international law doctrines of non-interference shielded the horrors of the Holocaust from public view. But then the war drew to a close, and people saw all the horror in its stark and unimaginable reality as American GIs spread through Germany and liberated the camp survivors. Never again became a rallying cry. A solution had to be found. Part of the solution was the Declaration of Human Rights, which begins with a proclamation of the inherent dignity of each human being and continues with a list of each person's inalienable human rights, like life, liberty, security of the person, equality before the law and equal protection of the law, freedom from arbitrary arrest and detention, fair and public hearing before an independent and impartial tribunal, freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, freedom of opinion and expression, an adequate standard of living, including health and food and education. Mr. Humphrey and others pressed for the establishment of the United Nations Commission of Human Rights, headed by the United Nations High Commissioner. 30 years was to pass before the commission became a reality. It's now headed by a Canadian who used to sit on the Supreme Court of Canada, Louise Arbour. And many question whether the commission has or will ever realize its potential. But nevertheless, I think it stands as a beginning. And the premise for which it stands, that every man, woman, and child on the globe, whatever their condition, wherever they live, is of equal worth and as such possess of inalienable rights, is the premise on which we can go forward into the 21st century. Although too often honored in the breach, the fact is that human rights have become a force to be reckoned with. The world, for the first time in history, has officially recognized the inherent dignity and equality of every human being. In a host of different ways, the current of tolerance is year by year strengthening and broadening in diverse parts of the world. I mention only a few. In many countries, refugee laws and practices have become more humane. In 1939, the ocean liner St. Louis was desperately trying to find a haven for 927 German Jewish refugees on board. Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Paraguay, and Uruguay refused to take a single refugee. So did the United States and Canada. In Canada, the director of the immigration branch explained that no country, and he quote, could open its doors wide enough to take in hundreds of thousands of Jewish people who wanted to leave Europe. The line, he said, must be drawn somewhere. Today, many refugees still seek haven. Today, the problem of sorting out genuine refugees from fraudulent pretenders remains a real one. Yet I would like to think that our respective countries would not turn away the St. Louis and return its passengers to the fate of concentration camps. More countries have adopted constitutional human rights provisions and are demanding that their governments stand by them. I say this in full awareness that many human rights declarations are not worth much more than the parchment they're penned on because the countries don't enforce them. But many countries do, and the United States stands as the leader in this respect, having introduced its Bill of Rights more than two centuries ago. Canada, South Africa, countries in all over Europe, and in many other parts of the world have followed suit. A Bill of Rights is important. It allows alleged abuses to be challenged in the courts, as has recently happened in the United States in connection with the incarceration of alleged enemy aliens in the Guantanamo Bay compound, and as you just heard, has happened in Canada in connection with the detention of persons deemed to constitute a threat to security. International efforts are also being made to outlaw some of the more brutal practices of warfare. On March 1, 1999, the Ottawa Convention came into force, banning anti-personnel landmines. The convention was the first disarmament instrument to ban a widely used weapon of war, in this case one that caused great pain and injury to innocent civilians, men, women, and many times children, long after the arms of war had been put down. The convention was the product of an intensive effort and a Canadian coalition-led coalition of governments, international agencies, and non-governmental organizations, including, famously, the late Princess Diana. Today, 152 of 192 countries of the world subscribe to the Ottawa Convention. World opinion is backing it. Not too long ago, when Pakistan recently floated planting landmines on the border with Afghanistan, international efforts persuaded it not to do so. A growing list of international covenants offer protection to children and protection against slavery and exploitation. Most notably, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which came into force in 1990. Again, the protection is neither complete nor perfect, but it represents a start. Finally, the world is beginning to chip away at the notion that sovereign nations have the right to abuse their people with impunity. Since the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, the golden rule of international law was that states were sovereign within their own territory, and that no matter how abusive or repressive their policies, other states were not entitled to intervene. That is slowly changing. In 2000, Canada proposed a new doctrine called the Responsibility to Protect. It's a carefully nuanced doctrine. It proposes that if a country is unwilling or unable to carry out its responsibility to prevent abuses within its borders, that responsibility can be transferred to the international community. The community's first recourse is diplomatic pressure and dialogue. If that does not succeed, sanctions and, as a last resort, military intervention are possible. In December 2005, after 5 years of debate, the doctrine of responsibility to protect was endorsed in New York at the largest gathering of world leaders in history, giving the world community the right to intervene if, and I quote, national authorities manifestly fail to protect their populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. The responsibility to protect doctrine affirms the sovereign right of each nation to manage its own affairs. It recognizes, however, that if the power conferred on leaders to protect their populations is instead used to destroy them, the world can and must intervene. In this way, it supplements other international steps that nations of the world are taking to fight government-sponsored persecution, such as extradition from safe havens to face justice in the home country, as in the Pinochet case, or in the newly operative International Court of Criminal Justice at The Hague, where the case of Thomas Lubanga Dailo of the Democratic Republic of Congo is currently going forward. The catalog of reforms that I have described attests to the efforts of men and women all over the world that they have devoted and continue to devote to strengthening and broadening the current of tolerance in the closing half of the 20th century. efforts that gathered momentum in the last decades of this century. Will the current continue to strengthen and broaden in the 21st century? Or will it weaken and wane to be ultimately submerged in the historically dominant tide of intolerance? The answer lies in the hearts and in the will of each one of us. Thank you very much.